Thank you very much, everyone, for turning up, especially on a kind of quite dreary sometimes Cambridge evening. It's my very great pleasure to introduce the first in our series of seminars that are going to be given by the York Distinguished Visitors to the Faculty of Law here at Cambridge. And it's my very great pleasure to introduce to you Lord Robert Carnwath, who's going to be talking to you today about Privacy International. He's also going to be talking to you a little bit about the run-up of the context of the Privacy International decision and also the recent series of ouster clauses removing CART judicial review. So it's going to give us plenty of opportunity to think about a very important and interesting case and its particular context. After that, my job is I get to play devil's advocate. So even if I, as I will, agree with everything Lord Carnwath says, I nevertheless have to pretend I don't, just to give you an alternative point of view. The hope is that that way we can open this open to discussions and Q&A so that you get a chance not just to listen to what we want to tell you, but also to take part. So please do have questions ready. Don't be embarrassed. There is no such thing as a silly question. We'll be very willing to listen to your questions and to answer them as we go. So I'm sure Lord Carnwath does not need any introduction, but he's going to get one anyway. Lord Carnwath came to Cambridge and read law at Trinity College. He then spent 24 years as a barrister at Landmark Chambers, mostly working in planning law and administrative law, and took Silk in 1985. During that time, he was also junior counsel to the Inland Revenue and Attorney General to His Royal Highness Prince of Wales, now, of course, King Charles III. He was called to the bench originally at the High Court and also before becoming a Justice of the Supreme Court and the Privy Council. He was also Chairman of the Law Commission and Senior President of Tribunals, playing a particularly important role in overseeing the legate reforms. He has a particular interest in environmental law, as well as we'll hear from today, public law, and is the Honorary President of the UK Environmental Law Association and of the Planning and Environmental Bar Association. As I'm sure you are very aware, he's been a key judge in very important public law cases, particularly Privacy International, but also, yes, we have to mention them because it's a public law seminar. Miller 1 and Miller 2. Right, I've done it. The heavens will not fall. We have mentioned the two important Supreme Court cases on public law. We can rest assured that we don't need to think about them again in this seminar. And so without further ado, it gives me great pleasure to invite Lord Carnwath to come and talk to you this evening. Thank you.
Yes, well, thank you for that introduction. Just a footnote to Miller 1. You may recall there was a certain amount of controversy about the Daily Mail saying that the people who decided the case below were enemies of the people. When it came to the Supreme Court, the Mail tried to sort of identify the 11 of us as to which were dangerously pro-European. I came out as a five-star pro-European because I happen to have an Italian wife, and I was said to be a lover of European culture, which indeed I am. But anyway, I then sort of rather threw them out because when our judgments came out, I actually dissented. I was one of three dissents along with Lord Reed in favour of the government. So then the Mail said that I was a champion of the people. And so I'm one of the few judges who can claim the credit of being a champion of the people in the eyes of the Daily Mail. Whether Privacy International would fall within that category, I don't know. It didn't seem to attract the same attention. Now, this is a slightly self-indulgent lecture because talking about one's own judgment is the sort of thing one doesn't normally get a chance to do. One of the disadvantages of it is one has to read the thing. And I don't know how many of you have actually read it. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but some of you may have done. If you haven't, I forgive you, because it does go on rather a lot. And I'll explain in a moment why that, I think, is so. But anyway, there it is. The underlying point was quite simple. And for those who haven't sort of rushed to catch up with it, I'll just remind you basically, the Investigative Powers Tribunal had given an important decision on the scope of the Secretary of State's powers to issue warrants authorising computer hacking for security purposes by the GCHQ. And the issue was whether that decision could be challenged in the High Court for error of law. Now, that was in the face of a statutory provision, Section 7(8) of the Interception of Communications Act 1985, which said in terms, determinations and other decisions of the tribunal, including decisions as to whether they have jurisdiction, shall not be subject to appeal or be liable to be questioned in any court. So on the face of it, the obvious answer was no. The tribunal's decisions could not be questioned in any court. But in the famous Annis Minnick case, dating from 1969, the House of Lords had decided that almost identical words in the Foreign Compensation Act 1950, Section 4, did not protect decisions of the Foreign Compensation Commission from review by the court, where they had gone wrong in law. They held, and I quote the headnote, the word determination in Section 4.4 of the Act should not be construed as including everything which purported to be a determination but was not in fact a determination because the Commission had misconstrued the provision of the order defining their jurisdiction. Accordingly, the Court was not precluded from inquiring whether or not the order of the Commission was a nullity. Now, that's, of course, an oversimplification of the very learned and elaborate reasoning of the majority speeches, but it gives the idea. Now, it's just worth reminding us of that what the Annis Minnick case was about. It concerned a claim to participate in a fund of some $27 million paid by the United Arab Republics to the British government in full settlement of claims arising from the nationalisation of properties at the time of the Suez Crisis. So it was a sort of defined fund, and some way had to be made, found to allocate it fairly. And the Foreign Compensation Commission was established under statute for with that purpose. Now, in the event, the House of Lords held that the Commission had misinterpreted the provisions relating to the right to claim compensation, and it held that, in fact, Annis Minnick had a claim which could proceed, contrary to what the Commission had decided. Now, that might be thought to have turned simply on a question of interpretation of law, but as you've heard, the House of Lords were able to decide that it was not a determination at all and therefore could be ignored for the purposes of the ouster clause. Now, that decision, going back more than 50 years, has never, in fact, been questioned as a matter of authority. It's been reaffirmed on several occasions in the House of Lords and the Supreme Court. And in particular, it was confirmed by Lord Diplock, sitting in the House of Lords in a case called O'Reilly and Macmahon in 1984. And that was shortly before the 1985 Act, which we're now talking about, was passed. Now, the only significant difference between the exclusion clause in Annis Minnick and the exclusion clause in the privacy case was the addition of the words in brackets, quotes, including decisions as to whether they have jurisdiction, close quotes. So what was being said was, apart from the Annis Minnick categories, we protect decisions as to whether they have jurisdiction. Now, for my part, whatever those words were meant to mean, it was very difficult to see how they made any substantial difference, because the tribunal's decision in our case was not in any ordinary sense, quotes, a decision as to whether they had jurisdiction. The jurisdiction of the tribunal in our case had not been put in issue by anyone, nor had they purported to make any decision about it. They had simply decided on the legal and factual merits of the case before them, as one would expect them to do. And so it seemed to me, as it did to the majority, that we were bound by the authority of Annis Minnick to hold that the ouster clause was ineffective to stop this particular claim, and so the claim was allowed to proceed to judgment on the merits. Now, there was a strong dissent, and no doubt Alison will take this forward. We'll see what she thinks of it. Lord Sumption, with the agreement of Lord Reid, dissented, as did Lord Wilson. And funny, it's interesting, I had, behind the scenes, I can say, I had quite a lot of discussions with Lord Sumption. It was over the sort of Christmas period, and we were sort of exchanging drafts. And it's quite interesting, actually, how the sort of judgments develop by that process. But we didn't agree. And he said this. He said, he read in response to what I had said, he said, but it is clear that the draftsman did not intend the same result as in Annismillik. This is because he has modified the formula by adding the bracketed words, which I've quoted. The effect of the bracketed words is to extend the ouster to the precise class of decisions which the House of Lords in that and subsequent cases had held not to be covered by the Annismillik formula, namely decisions in excess of jurisdiction. So that's what he said. But I'm afraid, with great respect, that that seems to be a non sequitur. If Parliament had wanted to exclude review of any decisions argued to be, quotes, in excess of jurisdiction, it could have said so, but it didn't. Lord Lloyd-Jones, who agreed with me, made the same sort of point. He pointed to the fact I mentioned that the decision of Lord Diplock in O'Reilly and Macron had preceded the enactment of the 1985 Act, and it made very clear what at the highest level was regarded as the effect of that clause and what was the effect of Annismillik. And so had the draftsman wanted to do precisely to reverse the effect of Annismillik in that respect, it wouldn't have been very difficult for him to devise words to achieve that effect. But the words in excess of jurisdiction didn't seem to me to achieve that. Indeed, in a sense, they seemed to go too far. And I expect the reason the draftsman did not use words like that was because he knew that such a clause, as suggested by Lord Sumption, even if it survived parliamentary scrutiny, it would go too far to be legally effective. Because as I showed in my judgment, it was well settled by authorities going back long before Annismillik, and accepted even by Lord Morris, the dissenting member of the House in that case, that no ouster clause could protect a tribunal which acted wholly without jurisdiction or in excess of jurisdiction in the traditional sense. The change made by Annismillik was not in any sense to advance the law in that respect. It was simply to extend that concept, rather improbably, to errors of law. Now, that was, I felt, you know, having, in a sense, it's quite comforting when you read the dissenting judgments. If you're not wholly convinced by them, you feel a bit more confident of one's own judgment. And this is the sort of process that goes on these difficult cases. It seemed to me also that our case was, if anything, a stronger case for court supervision than Annismillik, having regard to questions both of subject matter and effectiveness. I mean, as to the subject matter, Annismillik concerned a one-off claim to a share in a limited fund with no wider significance for the law or for individual rights more generally. Indeed, I doubt if any people, maybe Alison will tell us, remembers the precise issue of interpretation of law which was ultimately decided by the House of Lords in that case. And one could certainly see an argument, as indeed Lord Wilberforce said in his judgment, for a specialised tribunal dealing with a sort of distribution of a limited fund, having a special jurisdiction to deal with matters as quickly as possible without legal complications. But the same could not be said of Privacy International. I mean, this was an issue of wide-ranging public importance about the scope of the executive's powers to authorise interference with private property for security purposes. And as we recorded, Sir Mark Waller, a former Court of Appeal judge, in his 2014 report as Intelligence Services Commissioner, had expressed concern that the authorities' interpretation of that section might be too broad. So a matter of enormous general importance. And indeed, again, people may not have spotted this, that when, following our decision, the case went to the Divisional Court on the merits, the Divisional Court indeed decided that the Tribunal had got their law wrong. And that's reported in 2021, Queen's Bench. So it was a matter of extreme importance, which needed, I would have thought, to be decided by the higher courts. And I mean, and that, interesting enough, that decision of the Divisional Court has not been appealed, as far as I know. Furthermore, there was no obvious policy reason for an exclusion. I mean, there's some talk in the dissenting judgments about the secrecy element, but it's quite apparent that the Tribunal was well able to organise its procedures to ensure that a material point of law could be considered separately without threatening any security interest. And the other important point is a question of effectiveness. An exclusion in the annus minute context would have been completely effective because the only way for a claim to be made good to the compensation fund was through the commission. So once you said that the commission's decision couldn't be appealed, that was final. But that the same doesn't apply to the IPT, because its decisions, even if unappealable, would not establish the legality of the warrant for all purposes. Again, as we note in our judgment, it would not protect them against challenges to the validity of the warrant in common law or human rights proceedings, so that someone could bring an action in common law action against the authority for unlawfully hacking their computer, and that would be a matter for the ordinary courts to decide, subject to appeal in the ordinary way. In this particular act, there's not the sort of exclusion one finds in some of the planning acts, which is probably you know. You find a decision which says that a planning decision can only be challenged within 6 weeks, and then it says it shall not be questioned in any other proceeding. So you get a clear position that it's final. That didn't apply here. Now, so it seemed to me that there was quite a lot of reason, both the language, both the precedent, and both policy, for saying that a claim should be allowed to go forward. Now, you may think that all could have been said a great deal more shortly than we did say it. And so you may wonder, well, why did I go on at such length? And go on for an examination of the case law and commentary going back over four centuries and extending to 145 paragraphs. I must say, I was quite shocked when I looked at that again. I thought, God, is this ever going to end? But in fact, I had to deal with it with some depth because my simple solution had not been accepted by the lower courts or by my colleagues. But it also, in a sense, answered a personal need. Annis Micni was decided the year before I came to the bar, and just before when I first began to be interested in public law. And so it was a very sort of earth-shattering decision at the time. And I found it very difficult to understand then, as I have done ever since. How on earth could it be said that the decision of the commission was no decision at all, simply because they had made a mistake of legal interpretation? They had simply done their job. Their job was to decide all issues relevant to the claim, whether of fact or law, or judgment to the best of their ability, and that's what they had done. To say that that was no decision at all was really a contradiction in terms. My colleague Lord Wilson made this point very strongly. He said, their lordships in Annis Minute had strained the ordinary meaning of the statutory language, and so, he said, set up 50 years of linguistic confusion for all of us who have been heirs to their decision. And there's a sort of protest from someone who'd been struggling with this ever since he was like you, a student, listening to lectures on this subject. So I thought it was important at least to try and sort of find a principal answer to the case, which didn't depend on this sort of very odd concept of nullity. And anyway, if you want to, you can read my judgment, you haven't done so already. But in the end, it seemed to me that the key must lie in the concept of the rule of law, which was memorably enunciated by my former colleague, the late lamented Lord Justice Laws, in the case of Cart and the Upper Tribunal in 2011. I'll be coming back to that. In a passage which was cited with approval by Lady Hale in that case. And there he emphasised the need under the principle of the rule of law for statute law to be, quotes, mediated by an authoritative source, the paradigm, as he put it, being the High Court, as the principal constitutional guardian of the rule of law. And he went on, the need for such an authoritative judicial source cannot be dispensed with by Parliament. This is not a denial of legislative sovereignty, but an affirmation of it. So there he is saying in strong terms, later adopted by Lady Hale and others, that you simply, is a contradiction in terms to say under the rule of law that you can have something like this which is not subject to the jurisdiction of the court. Now, the rule of law as a concept was enshrined in statute in Section 1 of the Constitutional Reform Act 2005. And although it's not defined there, it's the subject of a chapter in Lord Bingham's marvellous book, which you may have been read, The Rule of Law. And he attributed the absence of statutory definition to the probable recognition by Parliamentary Council of, quote, the extreme difficulty of devising a pithy definition suitable for inclusion in a statute, and the wish, quotes, to leave it to judges to rule on what the term means if and when the question arises for decision, so enabling the concept to evolve over time in response to new views and situations. Now, it's important to note that the rule of law, although very well established as a concept in the common law, was given statutory form in the Constitutional Reform Act, and since it's a statutory provision, it's obviously the job of the judges to decide precisely what it means. And in that context, Lord Justice Laws' comments were very important. Now, having reviewed a range of cases on this, it seemed to me that the courts had not, in fact, adopted a uniform approach to ouster clauses and the like. But they had felt, as I put it, free to adapt or limit the scope and form of judicial review so as to ensure respect on the one hand for the particular statutory context and the inferred intention of the legislator, and on the other hand for the fundamental principles of the rule of law, and to find an appropriate balance between the two. And in conclusion, I suggested the answer lay in the simple proposition that it is ultimately for the courts, not the legislature, to determine the limits set by the rule of law to the power to exclude review. And I said this: this proposition should be seen as based not on such elusive concepts as jurisdiction, wide or narrow, ultra vires or nullity, but rather as a natural application of the constitutional principle of the rule of law, as affirmed by Section 1 of the 2005 Act, and as an essential counterpart the power of Parliament to make law. Constitutional roles, both of Parliament as the maker of the law and of the High Court, and ultimately the appellate courts as the guardians and interpreters of the law, are thus respected. Now, that statement has been subject to some criticism by people who say it's really not the role of the courts to exclude Parliament, but it seemed to me the only sort of logical explanation of the cases over the years. But I emphasise that this part of my judgment was not part of the majority judgment. It wasn't necessary for the decision because we decided that we were, by a majority, that we were bound by Annis Minnick, and so we didn't need to go on to consider these wider points. And Lord Lloyd-Jones, who wrote the other majority judgment, perhaps wisely reserved his position. So it's not in any sense a binding authority on this aspect, and it remains to be seen how, if at all, it will be applied or interpreted in the future. So that's Privacy International. I just wanted to talk briefly about the sequel, because it sort of ouster clauses came to the fore again, rather surprisingly, in 2001. And you may recall that then the government commissioned a review of the judicial review system under Lord Edward Foulkes. And he produced what I think is a very useful, practical report, making certain recommendations, which I certainly had no difficulty with. And he didn't, as I recall, regard ouster clauses as a particular problem. But in the government's response, they went further, and indeed in the covering letter from the then Lord Chancellor, he described ouster clauses as one of the, quote, pressing issues on which he wanted to focus attention. And this was explained further in a rather curious paragraph in the text, which said this: the government considers that the doctrine followed by courts since the Anismenic decision, which has led to many ouster clauses not being given effect to, is detrimental to the effective conduct of public affairs, as it makes the laws set out by Parliament far less predictable, especially when the courts have not been reluctant to use some stretching logic and hypothetical scenarios to reduce or eliminate the effect of ouster clauses. Some of the reasoning set out in Privacy International illustrates this very point. So there it was. I had been guilty of some stretching logic and hypothetical scenarios, whatever that means. The danger of an approach to interpreting clauses in a way that does not respect parliamentary sovereignty is, we believe, a real one. And the paper went on. The government, it said, did not think that the court's approach is, quote, totally incorrect. It's not often one hears the government saying that about Supreme Court decisions. But anyway, it's not totally incorrect. But thought that further clarity was needed to set out how the courts should interpret such clauses and the circumstances in which they must be upheld. Now, I found that passage puzzling on a number of grounds. I mean, whatever the government thought of the, quote, correctness of the reasoning in Anismenic, it had stood unchallenged for over 50 years and hadn't been challenged by government counsel in the case before us, or indeed in any other case, as far as I know. More importantly, the assertion that it led to, quote, many ouster clauses not being given effect was unsupported by any examples, and as far as I know, is totally wrong. I mean, I can think of one or two cases where an ouster clause has been given limited effect. Alison may be able to think of others, but to say that there have been many cases is, as far as I know, simply nonsense. And nor was it explained which parts of my judgment in Privacy were thought to involve stretching logic and hypothetical scenarios. It went on in this sort of vein. I haven't quoted it all. But I put in quite a strong riposte to that, as you may imagine, suggesting that they got it all wrong. I didn't get a response, but for whatever reason, that particular aspect of the consultation paper disappeared from the subsequent government consideration of this subject. And when the Judicial Review and Courts Bill came out, it basically limited itself to the reforms which had been recommended by Lord Foulkes, and there was nothing in it about ouster clauses. So I hope that's sort of the end of that particular chapter. But interestingly enough, the Act does contain an example of an ouster clause, which I would regard as wholly unobjectionable. Section 2 provides for an amendment to the Tribunal Courts and Enforcement Act 2007 to protect decisions of the upper tribunal on applications for permission to appeal by judicial review. It provides the decision is final and not liable to be questioned or set aside in any other court. In particular, the upper tribunal is not to be regarded as having exceeded its powers by reason of any error made in reaching the decision. B, the supervisory jurisdiction does not extend to, and no application or petition for judicial review may be made or brought in relation to the decision. So pretty clear terms, and the draftsman might have had a go at that back in 1985 if he really wanted to exclude the effect of Anismenic. But the background to this, Alison mentioned that I was involved as senior president of tribunals in the reforms which followed the review by Sir Andrew Leggett, former Court of Appeal judge. And the whole idea of that was to bring together the many diverse specialist tribunals into a combined system with a strong sort of upper level, which was an appellate level. And the idea was one would bring together in the upper tribunal the strengths of the specialist judges and the High Court judges. And so one could... There's no question need to regard the upper tribunal as being in any way inferior to the High Court, and therefore no reason for its decision to be subject to review by the High Court, although there needed provision as there was for appeals to the Court of Appeal and above. Now, I was involved in the legislation which gave effect to that, the Tribunal Courts and Enforcement Act of 2007. And I remember at the time we discussed with the parliamentary draftsman how we could ensure that the upper tribunal was not subject to judicial review. And it seemed, on the basis of the most recent Court of Appeal authority and the leading textbooks, that the way to do it was to designate it as a superior court of record. And that's what the legislation did. Now, unfortunately, that didn't survive the scrutiny of Lord Justice Laws in the when the case came before the courts in the Cart and the Upper Tribunal. Now, funny enough, I was involved also in that case because I was actually sitting in the Upper Tribunal, although I was a Court of Appeal judge at the time. I took the opportunity to sit in the Upper Tribunal with a very, very experienced tribunal judge. And we had refused permission to appeal in a case which seemed to be wholly without merit. And so it was our decision which was being challenged by judicial review in the High Court, and I slightly resented that, I thought. I mean, happily, the merits of our decision were upheld eventually in the House, in the Supreme Court. But it provided an opportunity for this issue to be raised as to whether this ARC attempt to exclude the judicial review was effective. And Lord Justice Laws, in a typically erudite and remarkable judgment, going back to authorities of the 17th century and so on, basically sort of exploded the doctrine that merely describing it as a superior court of record was good enough. And so that was the end of that. And so the government didn't even try and resurrect that particular argument in the higher court. So the Supreme Court never actually considered what we had thought to be the main point in the Act. And anyway, in that case, it was decided eventually in the Supreme Court that notwithstanding the superior status of the upper tribunal and the ability of to have High Court judges and above sitting in it, it was nonetheless not immune from the prerogative of judicial review. But they did say it should be limited to special cases by what is called the second appeal rule, which confines it to points of general importance. But the problem with that was that the real difficulty was in the immigration context, where there's a stream of applications for judicial review of the upper tribunal in cases, most of which were fairly clear-cut. And the success rate of those applications for judicial review was very, very small indeed, but it did clog up the workings of the administrative court. And so Lord Foulkes, in his report, said that that was a real problem which needed to be corrected, and he recommended that there should be an ouster clause which made clear that the upper tribunal would not be subject to judicial review, and the government accepted that recommendation. I've just said totally the clause. And now that seems to me is a very good example of an ouster clause doing its job properly. It's there's a very good reason for it. It doesn't exclude access to the court, because in cases which justify it, there's the right to go to the higher courts and ultimately the Supreme Court. But it does ensure that that's restricted in a way which is both rational and proportionate. So there one sees, interestingly enough, what an ouster clause should be about. So there we are. There the matter rests for the moment. Now it remains to be seen whether my wider proposition will ever need to be tested. I rather suspect not, because I think in the light of all that, the government may be very careful with any ouster clauses it tries to put forward in the future. And I hope and I believe that they will confine them to ones where it can really be justified and where they're likely to be upheld. So thank you very much.
There are some days where you get up and you think, this is going to be a very difficult day and I'm going to have a very, very hard job. And then you come to this and suddenly realise you have to find a way of arguing against Lord Carnwath when you mostly agree with what he says. So I will try my best. I've also seemed to have the very tricky task in that I have to decide that Privacy International was incorrectly decided and that, nevertheless, the ouster clause is also wrong and should be got rid of. So I have to be contradicting myself, but I'll try my best to put some alternative points of view. So what we have from Lord Carnwath is a particular focus on how the language, precedent and policy give rise to conclusions that the ouster clause in Privacy International should not have been able to succeed and could have been read down. So my job is to try and explain to you why language, precedent and policy might point in the opposite direction. Okay? So the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to remind you all that a long time ago in the other place, the dark side as I have to call it, where I used to live for 25 years, there was this place called person called Dicey. And he believed in something called parliamentary sovereignty, okay? And what parliamentary sovereignty does is it tells you that Parliament is the most important institution in the UK constitution. And it expresses its will by setting out provisions in legislation. And that's precisely what it was doing in the legislation that was setting up the ouster clause that failed to be reviewed in the Privacy International case. Now, if you look at the language, now we know that when you have a clause like anosmic, so in there it tells you that determinations can't be questioned in a court of law. But this is different. This clause has different wording. This says determinations can't be questioned in a court of law, and it adds these extra words in brackets, including these decisions as to whether you have jurisdiction. And that's important. Because surely that is Parliament clearly saying, even if you make a jurisdictional error, that cannot be questioned. And we all know that that's how anosmic worked. So there's my language. It's clear. It's obvious this is what they wanted to do. And we have a principle of parliamentary sovereignty. What about my precedent from anosmic? So I'm going to have to try and read anosmic differently. I'm trying. Okay, so here we go. So the way I'm going to read it differently is I'm going to say, well, yes, I know that the case law post anosmic wasn't just looking at jurisdictional errors. It was also explaining that after anosmic, legal errors are jurisdictional errors. But what's the organising principle? What's going on in these cases? And what's going on in these cases is that jurisdiction is the key principle. That's what's doing all the work. So the reason in anosmic that they could read it down, because there was the scope to say, but you didn't have jurisdiction, you acted beyond the scope of your powers. And we know that what happened in the case law afterwards is that legal errors became jurisdictional errors. So if you make a legal error, you have made a jurisdictional error. We know this because all legal errors are jurisdictional errors. Okay. So can you review this? Of course you can't, because it says even decisions as to whether you had jurisdiction or not can't be reviewed. Okay. I don't believe this. But I'm trying. Okay. So that's my precedent. Okay. jurisdiction is doing the bulk of the work. And we know it's within the language. And let's say I was a draftsman in the Parliamentary Council Office. What am I going to do? I'm going to put this in because I know that's how anismic worked. So if I send this signal in the language, I know that's how it's going to be read by the case law, and that's going to work, and I know I'm going to succeed in having written an ouster clause that will succeed in these circumstances, because I've said, even if it's jurisdictional, you can't question it. So you can't tell me this is a nullity because it was beyond jurisdiction. So that's not going to work. That's what this means. What about the policy arguments? Okay. Well, I'm going to go away and go back to my parliamentary sovereignty and have a look at the language. And I'm going to say, Parliament has set this out really carefully. It's tried to explain to me what I think the scope of the powers of the IPT actually are. Okay. And in doing so, it's thought very carefully about how is it going to set up this particular tribunal structure to take these decisions. Now, remember, this is to do with special issues of national security. This is overseeing decisions of the security services. So things like GCHQ, MI5, MI6, MI whatever the other numbers are. All of those are involved in national security issues. This is where you go. And these need to be considered very carefully in a special procedure that's nice and secure with special trained individuals that can take these special decisions in these circumstances. So they're a specialist body, a lot of experts who know what they are doing. So it's not really going to undermine the rule of law in the same way here, because you've got specialist trained judges, members of the Court of Appeal sitting on the IPT. They know what they're doing. They know how to apply the rule of law. And anyone can make mistakes, but a mistake by them is not necessarily going to be any different from a mistake by any other court. So we can justify not having judicial review in these circumstances because they have the special expertise to go away and take these decisions. And so I would suggest these are possible arguments for interpreting it in a different way. Why am I doing this? Because we have parliamentary sovereignty as well as the rule of law. And perhaps I'm going to have to side with some of the language of the government in response to the independent review of administrative law and suggest, that perhaps in Privacy International they were straining the language a little bit too far and clearly going contrary to the clearly expressed will of Parliament. I think I'm getting away with this. So what about the ouster clause? So my job this time to play devil's advocate is to try and explain to you that actually the ouster clause in the Judicial Review and Courts Act is an outrage and should be removed. Okay, so I've changed hats completely now. I think I'm no longer Lord Sumption. I'm now going to have to pretend to be someone else. So if I'm going to have to pretend to be someone else and tell you that I think it's an outrage, then I'm going to draw on arguments as to when most of these decisions tend to come to court. And they tend to be, as Lord Carmuth pointed out, immigration cases. And I know these immigration cases might flood the Court of Appeal, and there are lots of statistics that show that the vast bulk of judicial review cases that come to courts come from immigration backdrops. But I'd also like to suggest that these immigration backdrops are highly important, and that we need to have some form of constitutional safeguard in case, heaven forfend, and I know it's highly unlikely to happen because, as we've said, they're very highly trained judges in these tribunals, in the upper tribunal. But what if they got it wrong? And what if, in getting it wrong, that will put the life of an individual in jeopardy because someone who should be able to get asylum doesn't get asylum? And what if, by some terrible, terrible mistake, the upper tribunal didn't spot this and so didn't allow an appeal in those circumstances? Would we perhaps need some form of judicial review just in case, given how serious the consequences might be if, heaven forfend, a mistake was made and the upper tribunal failed to refer something on? So I've completely contradicted myself from my earlier position because I'm playing devil's advocate in two different ways. But hopefully in doing so, I've given you some food for thought. And it's now over to you So you can ask us questions. It doesn't have to be deciding which one of us you think might be more or less convincing. But you have a wonderful opportunity to ask questions, particularly of Lord Carnwath, if you really must, of me as well. But definitely of Lord Carnwath. And so I will step down and give you a chance to ask questions. Thank you.